From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
In Florida, those who sympathize with certain causes or ideologies could wind up being found guilty of the crime of domestic terrorism.
You can still decide you want to be a member of a designated terrorist organization because you align with them politically.
Also this week, political disagreements are becoming really problematic when it comes to relationships.
Both Democrats and Republicans, at least 64%, think that the other side is dishonest or more immoral than the average American.
We'll also get the latest on some funky financial issues impacting Florida's expanded school voucher program, and we'll discover that when it comes to keeping the state's Brightline trains on the tracks, that train may have left the station. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report, and our weekly wrap-up of top stories from the 2026 lawmaking session in Tallahassee.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org.
In recent days, the term domestic terrorist has been mostly used by the Trump administration in reference to people in Minneapolis. But it seems the phrase also has some connection now to Florida. Florida state law enforcement may soon be able to declare groups domestic terrorist organizations, subject to approval from the state cabinet. Tristan Wood reports a bill moving through the legislature also creates new penalties for people who support such groups.
John Harris Maurer with Equality Florida says he's concerned about how the bill defines domestic terror organizations. He says the current language isn't clear, and points to the use of the word coerce as an example.
It addresses actions intended to, quote, intimidate or coerce. Is that a rally on the Capitol steps? An op-ed calling for somebody to be removed from office? Acts, quote, dangerous to human life? Is that encouraging vaccines that the state doesn't support? It refers to action that is, quote, an ongoing threat to the security of our state. Does that include a strike or a boycott of major Florida businesses? If the answer is no, of course it's none of those. The language needs to be significantly revised because it lacks safeguards as written.
But Davie Democratic Representative Mike Gottlieb, who backs the bill, disagrees. He says the definitions for those terms are widely known.
This bill doesn't need to define coercion. Coercion is a common term. Coercion is threats intended to compel action or inaction. This bill doesn't need to define intimidation. Intimidation is conduct that reasonably causes fear or pressure. It's the common definition. That's what we do in the law. We don't define common things.
Others worry about the impact the bill could have on protests and political speech. North Miami Democratic Representative Dottie Joseph says it reminds her of efforts used to fight the civil rights movement.
In 1956, the state of Alabama sued the NAACP, arguing that it was causing irreparable injury to the property and civil rights of the residents of that state. And they used similar tactics as this bill. I don't think this is what you're trying to do, but this is what history teaches us. And part of what they argued against was providing material support during the Montgomery bus boycott. That's problematic.
But Dania Beach Republican Representative Hillary Cassell, the bill's sponsor, says she doesn't think her measure will have a chilling effect on speech and protests. For one thing, she says the bill is focused on providing material support. It bars state agencies, public schools, and private schools that accept state vouchers from receiving any funds from domestic terrorist organizations or using any funds to support those groups. University students would also face automatic expulsion for providing material support to such groups.
You can still decide you want to be a member of a designated terrorist organization because you align with them politically and ideology. This bill doesn't stop you from doing that. Now, if your membership results in knowingly, willfully, and intentionally assisting that organization in carrying out illegal terrorist acts, that's when your individual membership matters.
The conversation comes as the federal government has used the words domestic terrorism to describe the current protests in Minneapolis against Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Cassell says that has nothing to do with her bill.
So this isn't reactionary. This isn't in a response. This isn't to curb political discourse. This, in fact, is one of those bills that continues to protect it, because we are protecting this state, which we have an obligation to do, from terrorist organizations that want to disrupt this country and our right to free speech.
Another bill moving through the House would create a dedicated counterintelligence and counterterrorism division within FDLE. I'm Tristan Wood.
A new survey from Florida State University shows political disagreements are having an increasingly negative impact on relationships. FSU's Institute for Governance and Civics, known as the IGC, has a new report that looked at how disagreeing over politics is affecting our personal connections. Gina Jordan tells us it reveals plenty about America's political polarization.
The study finds that more than a quarter of Americans reported a friendship ended, and about a fifth of respondents said they've stopped talking to a friend because of political disagreements. Ryan Owens breaks that down for us. He's director of the IGC.
So there are two things really that I draw from this study. One is the fact that people are more and more, you know, siloed off from each other and concerned about politics, right? So that's one thing. The other thing, and perhaps this is a little bit more alarming from my perspective, is that our views of the other side, if you will, are becoming more and more jaded and negative, and that's a real problem.
It seems like it's getting pretty nasty. Did anything really particularly surprise you in these results?
So looking at whether people are pessimistic or skeptical about the left and the right being able to come together, I mean, both Democrats and Republicans, we're looking at, you know, 74% and 60% say that they don't think we can come together. Now, what we typically see is in things like emergencies, wars, things like that, people do come together, but it's just not good. This is just, there's latent negativity right now, and it seems to be growing. It's metastasizing in our body politic.
Yeah. The study shows, you mentioned pessimism, lots of frustration, rising stress around political differences. I can only imagine that these kind of emotions are instantly going to change the way we engage with each other. And in fact, we probably don't want to engage at all.
That's right. The more people begin to identify themselves or to define themselves with politics, it's going to become more and more difficult to deal with people who have a different perspective and define themselves a different way. So not only is it that you're disagreeing about politics, well, now all of a sudden it's like you're disagreeing with me and who I am as a person. And that's not good.
Yeah. When we think of political disagreements, that should be about policy or the values that guide us when we vote, right? But instead, it's turning into like moral judgments or personal judgments against other people. Did you see more of that in your research?
100% we did. So one of the questions we ask is, do such and such people, do they share your values? And do you think that they're more or less trustworthy or dishonest than the average person? Democrats and Republicans, 73 and 71% say the other side does not share my views. When we dig down a little further and we say, do you think that the other side is dishonest? There, we see some pretty alarming numbers. Both Democrats and Republicans, at least 64%, think that the other side is dishonest or more immoral than the average American. You can't have a well-functioning society when there's that degree of hostility, skepticism, trepidation about the other side. I mean, that's how, frankly, I mean, that's how civil wars start, right? I'm not saying that this is going to lead to that, but I mean, these are sort of the necessary preconditions for that kind of thinking.
Owens has data showing that those with a strong knowledge of civics are much less likely to engage in politically intolerant behavior. For more on how to navigate political divisions, I spoke with Christine Cox, director of the Village Square Tallahassee. The nonprofit hosts educational and social gatherings featuring diverse opinions.
Just times for people to come together and meet each other in a place where we've kind of set the bar at respect and listening, and that we're not trying to change each other's minds. That's another key. We're here to learn and we're here to understand and learn that, quote, the other side isn't the evil to our good.
Civil dialogue, respectful disagreement, that seems so far-fetched for so many people right now. What are we missing when we avoid having civil debate?
Oh my gosh, we're missing a lot. You know, it's understandable that in super toxic, polarizing times, people get exhausted, scared, apprehensive, whatever, and just go farther into our own silos and our own tribes or whatever term you want to use that says, this feels safe and comfortable, and I'm tired of feeling uncomfortable, and I don't want to do that anymore. But what that does, unfortunately, is that just makes the problem worse. We're doom scrolling and we're on social media, or we're only watching, listening, reading a particular type of media that speaks to us, and we're not consuming the broad spectrum that might open our mind to the other side of an issue or a perspective.
Yeah. What have you learned about human connection from bringing people with deeply different viewpoints into the same room to talk it out?
Oh my gosh, we see time and time again what a difference it makes. It just can be life-changing for people. They tell us, you know, right there in the middle of a program, or they tell us walking out, or in feedback surveys after, we're constantly wanting to make sure that our programs, our events are having an impact. So we're constantly asking that question and collecting that kind of feedback. But there's really nothing like leaving your labels at the door and coming in as humans and knowing we all have families, we all have hobbies, interests, different, you know, life experiences that we can share. And when you start just talking to people like that, like you might do at the grocery store checkout line or with a neighbor down the street, you're talking about the things that really matter the most, then something like politics is kind of like the 30th thing down the list by that point of what, quote, defines that person.
So while avoiding friends with differing political views may reduce conflict, the IGC report found that staying silent or withdrawing socially will reinforce political distance instead of easing it. The report concludes that civil political discussion instead of polite avoidance might be better for society. I'm Gina Jordan.
After Florida dramatically expanded its school voucher system in 2023, a report from last fall found the rollout was riddled with accountability challenges and impacted students who depend on these scholarships. Lawmakers are now trying to respond with new legislation. The Senate has passed a bill that would add some guardrails and make changes to how education funding is dispersed. WLRN's Natalie LaRoche-Pietri spoke with Noreen Dollard with the Florida Policy Institute about what the bill does to safeguard taxpayer funding.
There are a number of good elements to this bill. The Florida Education ID absolutely is a good approach. There are other things that they did so that payments are made more frequently. They're also changing the application windows to more closely reflect the education budgeting process, which includes estimates of how many students we expect to see now. So you get the estimates, then you're able to, you know, budget accordingly. So having those dates line up definitely is an improvement. We, Florida Policy and the education advocacy community, has asked for better reporting. There used to be regular reports from the Department of Education that at least provided basic information on students receiving the family empowerment scholarships or the tax credit scholarships. And those reports stopped in June of 2023. That, I think, would also help with accountability and transparency. Can it undo what's been done? I don't know that it can, but will it be a sounder system of managing my money, your money, every Floridian's money? I think going forward, it should.
What in the bill also caught your attention about how it's addressing the voucher funding organizations that handle the money for students on vouchers.
Reinstating annual audits of the scholarship funding organizations. So this will provide additional safeguards to the expenditure of those funds. The scholarship funding organizations should be able to more transparently show their business processes because these are tax dollars. I think the public has a right to know what's being done with their money.
The biggest change in the bill would be how education dollars flow in Florida. It would separate funding for public school students from funding for voucher students, and essentially, it would create two different pots of money. How would separating those funds help prevent the kinds of costly mistakes we've already seen in this voucher system?
Well, it would help because all the funding would be readily identifiable in the reports that are put out. So you could see exactly where and how much and where. It's slightly better accounting.
Are there potential negative impacts of that separation? Does it give lawmakers too much power to decide where the money goes?
The money goes based on the per pupil expenditures, so what they budget, and so that's the same whether you're a neighborhood school, a charter school, or a voucher recipient. It's the per pupil is exactly the same, and it has to do with enrollment projections. So I don't think it does that.
I was curious about what your take is seeing this legislation happen now after so many mistakes were made when it feels like in 2023 there were warning signs that people were already ringing the bell about.
Is the question what took them so long? And in 2023, immediately there were, people were talking about we're buying the all these things, surfboards and Disney tickets and things like that. But we already knew from because Arizona started down the universal voucher path a year before we did, and they were already seeing fraud and abuse. So, yeah, the question is, what took so long to really shore up these accounting practices that are not adequately protecting taxpayer dollars?
That was the Florida Policy Institute's Noreen Dollard speaking with WLRN's Natalie LaRoche-Pietri. The most recent report card from the National Assessment of Educational Progress finds that Florida students have fallen behind in reading scores. To help combat this, some Florida school districts have partnered with artificial intelligence learning programs to find a solution. WGCU's Jennifer Crawford recently spoke with Dr. Aaron Hamilton, the impact director for Amira Learning, to discuss whether AI can help get Florida students back on track.
A recent report from the Harvard Gazette says the average reading scores for high school seniors fell to its lowest level since 1992. Why do you think we are seeing such a decline in reading proficiency?
Yes, this is a statistic that we're talking about across the nation, but maybe not enough. The decline in literacy has unfortunately been stagnant. The literacy rates have been stagnant for the last decade or more. And our teachers are working very, very hard. Our leaders are working very, very hard in our schools. And what we're finding is what we're doing isn't moving the needle fast enough for what we need our students to have. So we're really seeing trends across the country going in this direction. And unfortunately, it's not the direction that we're wanting across the country for our students to have increased proficiency. We believe that the reason for that is really many factors. And one is really getting our teachers to understand the needs of our students. Prior to the pandemic, our students showed similar needs to after the pandemic. So, many people predict that the pandemic is to blame. However, we feel that that's not necessarily the case. Our students were really struggling with reading prior to the pandemic, and there's a lot of research to show that as well. So getting our teachers to build their knowledge of how we teach struggling readers has been a big challenge over the last decade. I think our nation is doing a really great job in improving that category, but that is an area that we're continually improving, as well as the tools. One thing that the pandemic did do is give our districts dollars to spend on tools. And so there were many, many tools that we were grabbing at and trying to use to solve this concern or this problem. And now we're finding so many districts evaluating those tools to see which ones are effective, which ones are having that great reason for our students to continue using it, and what are our families also continuing to use that's showing the trend line to go increase versus flatline.
Florida is reportedly one of the leaders in declining literacy rates with children. What are some of the issues children are facing causing this decline?
Well, I believe that having ability to get their hands on these tools in all across the state of Florida has been a huge challenge. Making sure that we have, you know, students in all of our counties getting similar tools at their disposal is going to be one way to help us make sure that everyone's getting the same chances and helping their literacy. I believe, again, Florida's doing a really great job of working hard in their schools. Our teachers work hard, our leaders work hard. But I just think that we're finding declines going on across the state. Well, I believe AI could be the change that we need to see across the country to change those student outcomes from the flat line to increasing reading proficiency. And the reason I believe that is there are many studies that Amira has done specifically to show that, again, the teacher is the center and they are the leader of the classroom. But using an AI tool like Amira for that assistant in the classroom. So I'll give you an example. The teacher is running a small group instruction. She has or he has a group of students in front of them while the other students in the classroom are busy doing their own independent time. And while they're on that independent time, they're using the AI platform, Amira, to be instructed on similar things that the teacher is doing with the students right in front of them. So instead of being left to do something that doesn't have a program that doesn't have the same effect size while they're independently working, the teachers that are using something like Amira with a great effect size, using that while they're not with the teacher is showing great gains across the country.
That was Dr. Erin Hamilton with Amira Learning speaking with WGCU's Jennifer Crawford. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, want to take a train trip? Well, if you're hoping to hop aboard Florida's high-speed Brightline train, you may be running out of chances. Brightline operates one of the nation's fastest passenger trains, but it's under pressure to grow ridership and revenue. WLRN's Tom Hudson reports the company's business is expanding, but just not fast enough to keep pace with its debt.
Brightline trains can go as fast as 125 miles per hour on trips between South Florida and Orlando. That makes it one of the fastest passenger trains in the country. But it's racing to boost its business fast enough to make its debt payments on time. And Trevor Doyle-Elise thinks the company may be running out of track.
They're just not getting enough people to get out of their cars, go onto the train at the right price.
Doyle-Elise is a managing director at S&P Global. That's a credit rating agency, and it made a deep cut to Brightline's credit rating late last year that included this warning.
They will default unless something happens.
Default means Brightline would not be able to make interest payments on its debt due next January.
I think they're about $20, $25 million short of that payment. So they have some money, but no. Then basically, under the indenture, the debt will be accelerated.
Meaning it will have to pay its debt back faster.
It will go into bankruptcy.
Now, this doesn't mean Brightline trains would stop running. Lots of companies, especially transportation companies like airlines, continue to run in bankruptcy as they reorganize. Broward County-based Spirit Airlines, for instance, is still flying despite entering bankruptcy for the second time in less than a year.
The public likes the product. Ridership is reasonably strong, but they're not paying top dollar.
This is Joe Schwederman. He's a transportation expert and director of DePaul University's Chadwick Institute for Metropolitan Development.
That price competition has been a kind of a boogeyman for him, you might say, keeping fares low, and that the numbers just aren't working right now. There's some reason for optimism, but it's a scary time.
The problem for Brightline is price. In December, the average fare for a trip between stations in South Florida was about $26. That's 11% cheaper than the average fare a year earlier. About $75 was the average ticket price for trips that started or stopped in Orlando, and that was about the same as it was a year ago. More passengers are riding the trains and paying those fares, leading to an increase in revenues, but the growth just is not fast enough.
People are just not switching from their cars in enough numbers to rail. And in addition, Brightline was doing a lot of discounting, particularly off the fares, particularly in the long distance. And then it was proving very sticky to get those fares up.
Doyle Elise with S&P Global thinks Brightline revenue was up about 14% last year and will grow by about 15% this year. But those numbers are less than half of the growth rate that was expected and about 80% below what Brightline itself was forecasting.
You know, we got this aspirational thing that we used to say when we started Brightline that, you know, we were going to create this car-free lifestyle.
This is Brightline CEO Patrick Goddard in mid-January speaking on a panel at a Greater Miami and Beaches Hotel Association event.
That was a bit too ambitious. And I think we would be happy at this point with a car alternative lifestyle where people can own a car but have options.
Brightline did not respond to emails regarding the credit rating downgrade and souring outlook by S&P Global. Transportation expert Joe Schwederman with DePaul University notes Brightline's troubles are not with its product, the train ride.
It's a beautiful system. The public loves it. But boy, that debt burden just keeps eating away a bit on that financial outlook.
What would they need not to default? That would be about a 50% growth in 26.
That would require more passengers paying more money for the rides.
Something good has to happen to make the numbers work. And right now, there's just enough headwinds that we're going to need some pretty big strategic shifts, I think, for Brightline to get the numbers to work. And investors are pretty nervous.
Some of Brightline bonds have traded as low as 33 cents on the dollar, a clear sign bond investors are fast becoming skeptical about Brightline's finances. The company deferred interest payments due this month on several of its bonds. That's the second time it's delayed payment. Its bond agreements allow it to postpone one more payment before it's in default. It also has negotiated how it can pay interest on some of the money it borrowed. It does not have to be paid back in cash. Now, Brightline has been telling investors for 6 months that it's looking to sell a substantial chunk of itself with the money used to pay down its debt load. Changing how some of its interest payments are made could allow Brightline to pay back some of its borrowers by giving them an ownership stake in the company. I'm Tom Hudson.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Natalie LaRoche-Pietri, Jennifer Crawford, and Tom Hudson. All of us at Capital Report owe a major debt of gratitude to our frequent technical support guru, Evan Rossi. His skill and expertise in crafting the show, often under insane deadline pressure, is a joy to behold, and he's always completed the task with grace and good humor. We wish Evan the best as he leaves WFSU Public Media, and we'll miss his smile and crazy jokes, too. I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.